The Interpreter Foundation would like to welcome all of you to a special panel discussion on the practice of plural marriage in the early church history. My name is Andrew Smith. I will be moderating and hosting this discussion with our panel of experts that we have assembled to talk about this important subject. So with specific regard to polygamy stands as somewhat of a difficult aspect of church history for some members today, as well as potentially a hang-up for many outside of the church as they either consider investigating the church or just generally in understanding what the church is and what it stands for. So we've invited this panel of experts here to discuss some of the more poorly understood or difficult aspects of polygamy in the Mormon context. So let's have a little bit of an introduction to everyone. In alphabetical order, we will start with Craig Foster, who is just right here next to me. Say hi, Craig.
Hi.
Craig Foster has over 30 years of genealogical and historical research experience, particularly in the areas of church history. He has authored or co-edited or co-authored 5 books on historical subjects, including 2 that touch directly on the subject of polygamy. With Newell G. Bringhurst, he was an editor of The Persistence of Polygamy, Joseph Smith and the Origins of Mormon Polygamy. And then again with Newell J. Bringhurst, he was an editor of The Persistence of Polygamy, From the Martyrdom of Joseph Smith to the First Manifesto. Likewise, he has also published numerous articles on the subject, as well as many other presentations about historical and fundamentalist polygamy ongoing. Next in our alphabetical order is Brian Hales, who is to the left on the screen. Brian Hales is an anesthesiologist active in Davis County, Utah, and Utah generally in the medical field. However, he is also an independent researcher and scholar of Mormon polygamy. He has authored at least a dozen articles or reviews on the subject of polygamy in a number of different venues. For example, Mormon Historical Studies, the Journal of Mormon History, and Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. He has also authored a number of books, for instance, Setting the Record Straight, Mormon Fundamentalism in 2008, as well as Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, The Generations After the Manifesto, and as well as Joseph Smith's Polygamy, a 3-volume series on the history and theology of polygamy in the LDS context, which he put together with Don Bradley, right?
Is that correct, right, Brian? Yeah.
Correct. Yes. Likewise, he has also presented multiple times on the subject at various forums and conferences, such as the John Whitmer Historical Association Conference, the Sunstone Symposium, and the Mormon History Association meeting, as well as the annual Fair Conference. He also is the webmaster of 2 websites related to research and publication on the subject, MormonFundamentalism.com and JosephSmithsPolygamy.com. Which are both good resources in those aspects. And last but not least, we come to Greg Smith over on the far right. Greg Smith is an old-style country doctor in Alberta, Canada, as well as an independent researcher and scholar. He co-authored a study which compared the ages of Joseph Smith's plural wives with Joseph's Mormon and non-Mormon contemporaries in Illinois and the American frontier in 2005. He wrote a detailed analysis of Utah plural marriage through the manifesto periods for Fair, and in 2008, he wrote a detailed review of Signature Books' Nauvoo Polygamy for publication in the Farms Review. He has spoken by invitation to the Miller-Eccles Study Group and addressed Fair conferences in 2009 and 2013 on plural marriage, and he is currently the managing editor of the Fair Mormon Wiki. So, as you can see, we have a lot of experience dealing with these issues. I didn't total it up, but I would guess that there's probably nearly 100 years of experience between all of these individuals, which is enough to take us nearly back to the Manifesto of 1890. So that's probably about as good as we are going to get as far as experience and research dealing with these issues. So with that, we will turn the floor now to Craig, who's going to give somewhat of a historical overview about the practice of polygamy. When did it start, how it started, why, including maybe some aspects from the scriptures of the standard works dealing with polygamy, and as well talking about some of the wives. So, Craig, take it away for us.
Okay, well, plural marriage, it is suggested that Joseph Smith introduced or had the plural marriage revelation as early as 1831. And there are several items of evidence that point to that. Probably the best item of evidence is the fact that Joseph Smith had undertaken the revision or the translation of the Bible in 1831 and was working on Genesis in February to March of 31. And a number of historians have suggested that he probably was influenced by references, positive references to the patriarchs, the early patriarchs practicing plural marriage, and probably went to the Lord in prayer to find out more about that and why that was acceptable at that time as opposed to later times. Now, how was polygamy started? It was started with Fanny Alger, and I understand that Brian may correct me on this. I guess Brian found out from some people that the name was Alger, Fanny Alger.
I think she said Alger.
Alger. Okay.
Alger. That's what she told me.
All right. So I've really been mispronouncing it all these years. But anyway, she was Joseph Smith's first plural wife. The experience appears to have been rather embarrassing and unpleasant, and we can get into that later. But it was short-lived and unpleasant enough that Joseph Smith appears to have waited until 1841 to try practicing plural marriage again. And it appears that he did it under a little bit of duress, I guess you could say, in that he later told Mary Elizabeth Rollins and a couple of others that he kept putting it off, and finally an angel with a drawn sword appeared and basically declared that that he had delayed fulfilling the commandment that he had been given, and that if he didn't do it, that someone else would be raised up to fulfill that commandment. And so the next plural wife, documented plural wife, was Loaysa Beeman, who was a sister-in-law of Joseph Bates Noble, who was bishop of the Nauvoo Fifth Ward and also a very good friend of Joseph Smith. From that point, Joseph Smith introduced plural marriage to very close associates of his, and he also obviously married a number of plural wives. So, continuing on with that, I'll leave it to Brian to maybe discuss in more detail the plural wives of Joseph Smith. But why was plural marriage introduced? There are a number of different reasons, you know, that have been given about why plural marriage was introduced, and one that I actually feel very strongly about was that it was a restoration or part of the restoration of all things. In 1874, Orson Pratt explained that the restoration of plural marriage was part of the, quote, restitution of all things, end quote, that had been prophesied in Acts chapter 3, verses 20 to 21, quote, inasmuch then as the Lord has promised to restore all things spoken of by the mouth of all the holy prophets since the world began, supposing that he should begin this great work of restoration in our day, how are we going to help ourselves? Brigham Young stated that Joseph Smith stated that he couldn't help it. Brigham Young stated that he couldn't help it. That God had commanded, and they needed to follow it. And the need for a restoration of all things was also mentioned in the Revelation on Celestial Marriage from section 132, wherein it says, quote, I am the Lord thy God, and I gave unto thee my servant Joseph an appointment, and restore all things. Ask what ye will, and it shall be given unto you according to my word. For I have conferred upon you the keys and power of the priesthood, wherein I restore all things, and make known unto you all things in due time. End quote. And so basically, this was one aspect or one reason why plural marriage was restored. But another one, which I kind of expound upon in an essay from the book that Newell Bringhurst and I co-edited, The Persistence of Polygamy, I talk about the fact that Joseph Smith's expanding concept of the eternal family, I think, played a part of this, or I should say that as he understood these things, they were revealed line upon line, precept upon precept, so that Joseph's understanding continued to expand where he began to get a full picture, plural marriage being just a part of that. In 1830, we had the restoration of the church. In 1836, the prophet Elijah appeared to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery in the Kirtland Temple and restored the power to seal families together for eternity. 1838, Joseph taught that all people who had lived and not had a chance to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ and have the ordinances performed must do so before the final judgment. 1840, Joseph Smith taught that families were to be transformed into eternal units. He explained that, quote, a man could be sealed to his wife, and after death, God would recognize the validity of their union, end quote. 1840, baptism for the dead was introduced, and there was a fervor and enthusiasm among the Nauvoo Latter-day Saints that was almost palpable. 1841, Joseph Smith recorded a revelation regarding baptism for the dead that placed the practice within the larger gospel context or framework. 1842, the temple endowment ceremony was introduced, and throughout the rest of 1842, 43, and 44, couples continued to be initiated into the temple endowment ceremony, and sealings were performed. Plural marriage was thus a part of this celestial marriage. All of this was part of a continuously developing, interrelated understanding of eternal family and exaltation. Richard Bushman, who, of course, authored Rough Stone Rolling, the biography of Joseph Smith, explained, quote, nothing in his later life excited Joseph Smith more than the idea of joining together the generations of humanity from start to finish, end quote. Now, I also want to talk really quickly about, and I'm sure I'm running out of time, and I apologize, but I was also asked to discuss marriage age and the idea that Joseph married underage girls, you know, took them as his wife. The idea is to place it within a greater context. I had the honor and the privilege of working with Greg Smith and David Keller on an essay titled The Age of Joseph Smith's Wives in Social and Demographic Context, which also appears in the first volume of the, excuse me, of The Persistence of Polygamy. And in it, we tried to put it within context of what was going on and why marriages might take place of what we would consider nowadays to be very young girls. Basically, America, colonial America, and then early Republic America, inherited its customs regarding marriage eligibility from Christian Europe. And in Europe, like other parts of the world, the age of consent originally had been generally based on biological development. European countries traditionally set the age of consent between 12 and 14, but followed the Roman tradition of, quote, an absolute minimum at age 7, end quote. Between age 7 and puberty, there could be consent to marriage, but the marriage could not be consummated. But ancient Rome generally accepted that the age of menarche, or onset of menstruation to be around the age of 14, but recognized that it could occur in young women as early as age 12. And so while some upper-class Roman girls married around age 12, most of them tended to marry at about age 14. Roman Catholic canon law followed Roman law in that canon law recognized the right to marriage to be 12 for girls and 14 for boys. English common law followed Roman law and canon law. English common law recognized the minimum age of marriage of 14 for males and 12 for females. In medieval and early Renaissance Europe, age at first marriage for both sexes varied by time and place. For a good portion of that time, the average age of marriage for females ranged between age 13 and age 17. In the 16th century, there appeared to be a shift to a higher age of menarche, which obviously corresponded with a shift to a higher age of marriage. And this was particularly so in Northwest Europe and the British Isles. So by the time that colonists came over to America, traditionally in England particularly, the marriage age was older. In the Celtic fringe of Scotland and Ireland and that, it still tended to be a little bit younger, but older than in other parts of Europe, particularly Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe. But when the colonists came to America, they based their traditions on the English common law, but because they were on the frontier and settling, what happened was the marriage age decreased, and so the young women married at a much younger age than they would have in England, and that was because of being on the frontier conditions of trying to create new communities, etc. Now, as the communities were settled in along the eastern seashore, the marriage age began to rise again. But the further west settlement went, the marriage age would decrease. So particularly on the frontier and in the backcountry, a pattern of early marriage and large families was opposite to the pattern of later age of marriage in England and northwestern Europe, and by that point along the eastern seashore of the United States. And there's a great quote that is from John MacFarriger's Sugar Creek Life on the Illinois Prairie. Quote, "A trip westward was almost a demographic journey back in time. Family sizes in communities further west mirrored those in much longer settled places a generation or two previously. The women of Sugar Creek, Illinois, for example, were married 4 to 5 years younger on the average than those in Sturbridge or Deerfield, Massachusetts." Now, what defines the frontier? Because we have said that, well, Nauvoo was on the frontier. And there have been some people who have said, well, Nauvoo wasn't on the frontier. It was in Illinois. It had a city of brick homes and laid out streets, et cetera, and so forth. But the definition for frontier is a region just beyond or at the edge of a settled area. And another definition is the extreme limit of settled land beyond which lies wilderness. Across the Mississippi River for 1840s Illinois was wilderness. From the Iowa Historical Society, they state that the frontier period for Iowa was between 1833 and 1870. Settlement extended from southeast Iowa to northwest Iowa, with the 1830s and 1840s Iowa frontier being still down in the southeast corner of Iowa. So finally,
Can I just jump in here for a second?
Yes, sure.
Sure. It may be worth, to understand this, I think it's really important to understand what it is about the frontier that does this. You know, what creates this environment that promotes younger marriage? And it's a few things. One is it undoes some of the things or undoes, I should say, it undoes some of the things that promote later marriage, and that is that land is no longer expensive. You have to remember, most young men getting married needed a farm. That's how they were going to support a family. In Europe especially, land was very dear. It was very hard to come by, and that was true in the eastern United States in long still parts. But on the frontier, you could have a farm just by, you know, going out and plunking down your shack, starting to clear the land, and you were set. So one obstacle to late marriage was removed. The second is, to make that work in an economic context, you needed a husband and a wife. A single man could not, or a single woman for that matter, could not make a go of a farm on their own. In our article, for example, we talk about a man talking about how he got himself a farm and then he went back to find himself a wife to help run the farm. He found the farm first and then said, all right, now I can get married. I need somebody. The third thing is that children become an asset on a farm. They're not a net drain on resources. They're actually advantageous because they're cheap labor, which is something my father certainly continued to practice. And then the last thing is that, like you talked about, the age of menarche, or the age when menstruation starts, varies. And one of the most potent things to making that vary is the nutritional status of the women as they grow up, especially a high-protein diet. That's vital. So again, on the frontier where you've got lots of animals, where there's a lot of meat consumed, that's going to promote that. So you have kind of this perfect storm that gets generated that's going to promote younger marriage, that's going to get rid of some of the things that that drug marriage ages up in other parts of the world, and made marriage almost a necessity, if you will, from an economic point of view.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, and you know that was in our essay, but trying to save time, I jumped over that, which I probably should not have, because it really does add a very important aspect. And even in England, the age of menarche varied between young women who were out in the countryside, who were in the farming villages, versus those who were in Birmingham or Manchester, etc. So, yeah, very good point there. I wanted to mention that the marriage laws, as I said, following the English common law, most of the states and territories, when they were created or when they were creating their laws, they had as the minimum age of marriage 14 for males and 12 for females. And that lasted throughout a good portion of the 19th century. It really wasn't until the beginning of the Progressive Era that the age of marriage began to rise. So between 1887 and 1906, there were changes to minimum marriage age that took place in a number of states. During this time period, six states still had age 12 as the minimum age for girls. And these included Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Missouri, Rhode Island, and Virginia. But during that time, New Hampshire changed the minimum age from 12 to 13, and I brought that out for a specific reason. So that was an example. And then eight other states still had the minimum age at 14. Illinois continued to have the minimum age of marriage as 14 for females, until they finally changed it to age 16 in 1905. 12 states did not even have a fixed minimum age as late as 1906. And these states were Colorado, Connecticut, Florida, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, etc. I don't want to take the time to read them all. But interestingly enough, according to a Mediaite article, from 2012, the minimum age of marriage across the United States continues to include some states with age 14 for females. These states include Alabama, New York, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And there is even one state in the Union that still has 13 as the minimum age, and that's the state of New Hampshire. Eight states have 15 as the minimum age, and from there it goes up. But interestingly enough, while the minimum age of marriage is listed in all of the states, at least 28 of the states allow marriage at a younger age under special circumstances, and it didn't define what all of those special circumstances would be. So even today, while we find the thought of, you know, of a 13, 14, 15-year-old getting married to not be a very pleasant thought, you know, we kind of look askance at that nowadays, there are still states that technically have that as their minimum age because it falls back to this history of common marriage age. So that's basically a really rough overview of what I was asked to talk about.
No, thank you very much, Greg. That was very informative. A lot of info there for people to think about. Does anybody else have any comments or questions they want to add here to anything Craig said? Maybe I'll just jump in with a couple little questions here. I mean, you talk about the legality of marriage. You mentioned that, of course, today we have very many social taboos and social norms that restrict marriage to older ages. I mean, you talk about how we look askance at 13, 14-year-olds getting married. I think you could probably bump that number up to 24, 25, and a lot of people in the U.S. today would think that anybody getting married at that age is getting married way too young. But that's a whole other podcast.
To give you an example, my oldest daughter got married in May, and she was 20 at the time of her marriage, and she turned 21 in July. But I have a friend from Ireland who congratulated me on the marriage of my daughter, and he asked, now, how old is she? And I told him the age, and he goes, 20 years old! And he could not believe that a young woman would marry at such a young age. So, we have that.
We definitely have that. And so kind of my question is, I mean, we talk about minimum marriage ages, but what types of social norms and taboos regarding age were there at the time? Would marrying someone as a 14-year-old or a 12-year-old, would that be extremely out of the norm? Would it be looked down upon? Even if it's legally possible, what would be the reaction?
Yeah, marriage at age 12 would be considered extremely out of the norm. As a genealogist, I have actually found, come upon several marriages, looking in various marriage records. Most of them were in the West or the South, but I have found some at age 12, more at age 13, a number at age 14, and then, you know, on up. But marrying at age 14 would not have been considered scandalous. It would have been pretty much, particularly on the frontier, it would have been considered acceptable and certainly would not have raised any eyebrows at age 14, 15 on up. As I said, age 12 would have been considered pretty young, but I think they would have looked at the circumstances of why they married at that age, etc. In terms of age differences, generally on the frontier, age difference would be anywhere from about 5 to 7 years. Older than it would be, let's see, I might get that wrong, 3 to 5 years older than what it would have been back in like the Midwest or back East. And am I correct on that, Greg? You're much better at the stats than I.
I think that's roughly true, yeah. I mean, you got to remember there's kind of an economic dynamic that happens here. When women become economically important to all this, again, that's going to drive marriage ages down. It's just kind
absolutely
of simple supply and demand. And the other thing about whether it would have been considered, you know, whether it would have raised eyebrows, again, I don't think people were, from what I've read, basically sitting around counting people's ages. What really counted was what the woman or the girl looked like. If she looked like a woman, if she looked physically developed and, you know, ready for childbearing, essentially, then she was ready for childbearing as far as they were concerned. It had much more to do, And it's interesting, the one wife of Joseph's that you often hear them complaining about, Helen Mar Kimball, who was 14, there's no evidence that that marriage was consummated and right. considerable evidence that it was not. But even so, it's very interesting that Helen makes a comment about how she appeared much older than her age, than her contemporaries. Mm-hmm. She talks about that. And so Helen was very probably someone who, polygamy aside, would have been considered marriageable material, I think. And it's yeah. interesting that she makes that distinction. It's something that we wouldn't really think of, but in her time and place, it was, you know, it was kind of, I think, her way of saying, and so of course I was ready to be married because I looked it.
You know, and I've read some various accounts in when I was working on getting background information for the article that we did. I went into a lot of different sources, some various diaries, you know, histories, giving accounts, you know, and I'll admit this is, you know, colloquial evidence, but, I saw several references. One, which I thought was really, really amusing, this woman was remembering later in life. She said that this was in Colorado, and she said that her brother was getting married, and a friend of his who had a ranch came into town to go to the wedding, and he was, if I remember correctly, about 28, 29. He commented to her that he had always thought that she was mature for her age and attractive, and he really wanted her to be his wife. And so on the spur of the moment, she said, why not? I was almost 14, and I figured it was high time that I got married. And so she married him, and it was a double wedding the next day. But, I mean, you know, so there are examples. I remember reading a reference. In fact, actually, this was a letter written by one of the survivors of the Donner Party, who talked about the fact that any young girl who came out there, you know, from at least age 13 on up, that they were considered marriageable age because there were so few girls. She made the comment that even, and I can't think of the name of the girl who is about 16 or 17, but I guess not considered very attractive, that even she was married very quickly after arriving in California. So like Greg was saying, it really did depend upon the economy in terms of women who were available. And the less women available, the younger the age went, you know, for marriage age. I like to give an example when I hear people say, oh, well, it's just the Mormon thing. I mentioned about my ancestor who was 13 years old. And she married, her husband was anywhere from age 28 to 31, depending on the record that you look at. And I mentioned, and she was a Catholic French Canadian. So it it all depends on time and place.
Interesting. Some very interesting stuff. Maybe if we have time at the end, we'll come back at another couple questions about Fanny Alger, if that's how you pronounce it now. But let's go on and move on to Brian. Brian had some things to share with us about polyandry and some information about some of Joseph's polygamous wives and potentially their offspring. So, Brian, take us away.
Great. What I thought I would do is simply give an overview of polyandry, and we're going to move kind of quickly. There'll be some new ideas for people who really haven't thought about it very much. Polyandry means, in the context of polygamy, it means a plurality of husbands, a woman having more than one husband. And within Joseph Smith's plural marrying, it really has significance only if we talk about sexual polyandry. And by that, I mean a woman who has two husbands with whom she's having conjugal relations. And so as I discuss polyandry, that's really what I'm talking about. Another form of polyandry, there were men and women who would get separated, or they would leave their spouse and go off either across the ocean or migrate to another part of the country. And not see their legal spouse for years, and then they would remarry. And they would be able to do this either because they didn't tell anybody or people just didn't care, but they'd have a second marriage ceremony. Technically, those people are polyandrous as well. A woman would be. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the allegation that Joseph Smith would have a plural wife and he would have sexual relations with her and then send her off to her legal husband to have sexual relations with him, all within the space of a few days or weeks. My position is this never happened. But it's a real uphill battle to argue, so we're going to talk about a few observations, I think, that will help people understand it did not happen. But let's look at that first slide there, if you don't mind, Andrew. As I say, this is an uphill battle because virtually everybody who has written on this topic, from Fawn Brody even to some people on the FAIR website, have said, yeah, Joseph practiced sexual polyandry, or maybe he did. I think we're moving some people over to the he didn't category, but right now I'm feeling a little bit alone. But I'm confident that as the evidence gets out there that we will see that that Joseph really didn't and wouldn't. He wouldn't even have tolerated it. But what's interesting is that if we look at the context of sexual polyandry, we find there are three references to it in Section 132. They all label it adultery. This is verses 41 and 42 and 61 through 63. And then if you look at every statement I have been able to find from 1843 to 1905, and for example, Brigham Young was asked in 1852, what do you think of a woman having more husbands than one? Brigham Young answered, this is not known to the law. 6 years later, Orson Pratt wrote, God has strictly forbidden in this Bible plurality of husbands and proclaimed against it in his law. And I've got a whole bunch of other quotes. I won't list them. They're in my books. Belinda Marston Pratt, George A. Smith, an apostle, his wife, Bathsheba Smith, and later on Joseph F. Smith and Joseph Fielding Smith. Every single reference to plurality of husbands is condemned as adultery. And yet we have a large number of authors saying, oh, yeah, Joseph did it. So you got to ask yourself, what is going on? Well, Joseph Smith taught that it couldn't happen with God's permission. What he tells us in section 132, verse 4, is that eternal marriages, whether they're monogamous or polygamous, that they are part of the new and everlasting covenant. In other words, Joseph Smith restored to the earth, according to his teachings, the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. The reason that this is important is that 10 years earlier, 12 years earlier, he had given us section 22, verse 1, that tells us that the new and everlasting covenant causes all old covenants to be done away. So from a religious standpoint, the legal covenant of a civilly married woman is done away as soon as she is sealed in the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. She doesn't have two husbands after that with whom she could experience sexual relations, at least not according to Joseph Smith's teachings and revelations. So going back to her legal husband, as so many writers have portrayed these women doing, it would be adultery, which is exactly what we find described in Section 132. In the eyes of the church, the sealing in the new and everlasting covenant caused the old marriage, the legal marriage, to be done away. This is very important. Well, the question comes up, how many of Joseph Smith's plural wives had legal husbands? The answer, by my accounting, is 14. By Todd Compton's, it's only 12. But and we can talk about some of those differences. To understand, though, what was going on is a little complicated because these 14 sealings were not of the same type or duration. Contrary to what a couple of authors have tried to say, bending over backwards, to say that eternity-only sealings did not occur, they did. And if you'll go ahead with the next slide there, Andrew, what we have here is a handwritten note. That's Andrew Jensen. He was an independent scholar at the time that he was making these interviews. But he's interviewing a novel polygamist, and we don't know who it is, but here he talks about how Ruth Vos Sayers was encouraged by her non-member husband, Mr. Sayers, to go and be sealed to the prophet for eternity. But she was going to remain his husband, that is Mr. Sayers' wife, I'm sorry, she was going to remain Mr. Sayers' wife in this life. This is the very strong evidence of an eternity-only sealing. And in fact, there's quite a lot of evidence of eternity-only sealings, not just for Joseph Smith, but for other men like his uncle John Smith and other men. These did occur, and this is a very important evidence. Now, the question comes up, why would women choose to be sealed to Joseph Smith? Go ahead to the next slide. The answer really isn't that complicated. Lucy Walker quoted Joseph Smith as saying simply, a woman would have her choice. This was a privilege that could not be denied her. Now, of the 14 women, I believe that 11 of the women chose Joseph to be their eternal husband in eternity-only sealings. Now, that's 11 of the 14. Now, some of those men were actually devout Latter-day Saints. Some of the men were non-members or were inactive members, so we can understand why those wives would choose Joseph in eternity. But the question still comes up, why would a woman choose Joseph to be her eternal husband rather than to be sealed to the legal spouse? And to be honest with you, we really don't know. It seems very strange to me even today. But a couple of stories need to be clarified, and this is that there is no evidence that Joseph ever forced a woman to marry him. There is a story going on out there that Joseph met a woman and gave her a 24-hour ultimatum to marry him or she'd be cast off forever. This is just folklore. Now, it is based on some truth because Lucy Walker met Joseph and Joseph proposed to her in 1842. And then it was in 1843, at least 4 to 16 months later in May, actually April 30th, that she says that she was tempted and tortured beyond endurance until life was not desirable. The prophet discerned my sorrow. He saw how unhappy he was. So after waiting for many, many months, Joseph could see how distraught she was, and this is when he said, look, we're going to give you 24 hours to figure this out. Now, what's interesting is after he tells her that it's a commandment and that she has 24 hours, she says, this aroused every drop of scotch in my veins. For a few moments, I stood fearless before him and looked him in the eye. And so she defies him. You know, Lucy Walker and these other women weren't these gullible dupes that so many writers like Fawn Brody portray them to be. They were just as skeptical and cynical as you and I, and they had the exact same questions. But what's important is that after this happened, that very night, she went home and she prayed, and one account tells us that she saw an angel that night, but she had a divine manifestation that plural marriage was a true principle. And see, when people talk about Joseph giving this ultimatum, they forget to tell them that, oh, by the way, there had been at least 4 to 16 months between the initial proposal and when it was readdressed, and that it only came after Joseph saw how distraught she was, and that night after he gave it, she received a divine manifestation. And there are people in Sweden, I think it is, that are apostatizing over the folklore that Joseph was giving a woman an ultimatum. There's also a notion that he forced women saying, if you don't marry me, I'm going to ruin your reputation. This actually comes from John Bennett, who was a prevaricator. We actually know of 5 women who turned Joseph down, and the only reason we know about these is because they later told somebody. If they had kept it quiet, we never would have known. Now, Joseph did defend himself against Sarah Pratt and Nancy Rigdon, both of whom accused him of impropriety. But if they had kept quiet, the pattern that we see in these other 5 women is it just would have gone away. In fact, one of the women was approached by Joseph. Her husband was a non-member. I believe it was just so that she'd be sealed for eternity. But she said to him, I asked him to teach it to someone else. He looked at me reprovingly, saying, will you tell me who to teach it to? God required me to teach it to you and leave you with the responsibility of believing or disbelieving. He said, I will not cease to pray for you, and if you seek unto God in prayer, you will not be led into temptation. Does this sound like a threat that he's going to ruin their reputation? So anyway, this whole notion that Joseph is forcing or compelling women to marry him needs some evidence. Otherwise, it just needs to go away. Now, I mentioned 11 of the 14 women with legal husbands were just for eternity only by my accounting. Now, the 3 remaining women were sealed for time and eternity, which probably included sexual relations. 2 of them, Sarah Ann Whitney and Sylvia Sessions, were already physically separated from their husbands, and we could talk more about them if you'd like. The 3rd woman is Mary Heron, and we just don't know anything about her. If anybody tells you any details, well, get their sources because they're probably just making it up. Let's go to the next slide. This next slide is actually the summary slide where I outline all 14 women. I think most of these were eternity only except for the last 3. And in those three cases, the women, the husbands were just acting as a kind of a front husband for Joseph, but not experiencing sexual relations. So were there sexual relations in some of these marriages? Yes. Were there polyandrous sexual relations? No. And this is something I get misquoted on all of the time. Let's try the next slide, if you will. The important thing is, I mentioned earlier that it's strange. Something strange going on by my accounting, and it was. But we need to recognize that the people who knew what was going on, these individuals did not complain. In other words, Joseph Smith did not defend it. He did not explain it. Neither did any of the wives. Neither did any of the husbands, the legal husbands, the officiators or witnesses. Even anti-Mormons didn't complain about sexual polyandry until 1850. And when you look at all of the accounts, it's like sexual polyandry did not even exist in Nauvoo. And that's where I am coming from. I don't believe that he would have allowed it. I think he would have called it adultery if, in fact, it would have occurred. Now, go to the next slide. Because if we look at this historically, what we find is that it was first reported in 1842. Bennett mentions that some of Joseph's plural wives has had legal husbands, but he doesn't exploit it. The first complaint, again, is in 1850. But then every statement from every leader and member that I've been able to find up until 1943 condemned the practice. So you got to ask yourself, well, how come everybody today seems to be so sure that he did it? Well, next slide, and this is my last one. What we find is that in 1945, Fawn Brody wrote in her book, No Man Knows My History, writing that Joseph practiced it and almost establishes it as undeniable. The irony is that she had no evidence to support it whatsoever, none that I found, none that she promoted. But the saddest part is that as a chapter in Mormon history, for the next 50, 60 years, not a single LDS scholar or historian or apologist came to her and said, hey, Fawn, let's see your evidence. Well, now's the time for transparency on this issue. I hope that we can get away from the nonsense that he practiced it unless there's some kind of evidence. I've actually gone to several very prominent scholars. You would recognize their names. I said, look, bring me the most damning evidence that Joseph practiced sexual polyandry. I've yet to receive anything from any of them. And that's a challenge I'd offer to anybody. We need to look at the evidence and then see if this is happening.
Well, the one thing I would add, and Brian, you may not feel like you've converted many people, but you've shifted me.
Yay!
So you'll rejoice with me, if no one else, I suppose.
Thank you.
The smoking gun for me was always a wife named Sylvia Sessions Leon, who it seemed quite clear to me had had sexual relations with Joseph and had probably conceived a child by him, while we were using her as kind of a test case, you know, it was very hard to say, well, there was sexuality in that relationship, but no other one. But then you found some more evidence about her date of marriage, which I think you ought to explain, and that kind of cut the feet out from under that argument. And once she went away, then kind of the rest of this kind of airy-fairy evidence that was around, you suddenly had to take a second look at and say, well, wait a minute, maybe I've been misreading this, and that's certainly what I did. So I think you should tell a bit more about Sylvia's wedding date and how that shifted the balance of probabilities.
Well, I appreciate that, Greg, and that is important because Todd Compton, using a document in the Joseph F. Smith affidavits that he collected in 1869, there's a document there. It's not signed. We don't know how close Sylvia was to the writing of it, but it gives a date of 1842, February 8th. Todd Compton uses that date with a high degree of confidence, and then we find that Sylvia later does become pregnant, I believe, by Joseph and has a daughter, Josephine, who was born February 8th, 1844. So the assumption is that we know she was living with Windsor in February 8th of 1842, and if that is the marriage date to Joseph, then this idea of sexual polyandry is somewhat supported. And I think Todd still defends this timeline. I've exchanged some emails with him, and I think he still thinks it's valid. The evidence supporting it is not strong. And the reason is that in that same set of documents, and apparently Todd missed this, but it's not necessarily his fault. He told me that he'd been working at the archives for 2 weeks and been asking to see these affidavit books. They didn't give him access until Friday afternoon. He had like 2 hours to go through them. The document he needed to see was in book 4, and there's 4 books. And it gives the exact same, almost the exact same a statement, except it has an 1843 date, February 8th, 1843. And also we notice that February 8th is the birthday of Josephine. It undermines both all of the dates. And so we really have to look at other evidences, and there's strong evidence that Windsor was excommunicated in November of 42 and that the marriage occurred after that. The couple separated. I think there's pretty good evidence just to support that. Again, Todd goes against me, and I'm more than happy to meet him on the evidence with this. But it's consecutive marrying. And there was no legal divorce, but the two separated, and as long as the new and everlasting covenant was in place, that was up until Joseph's death, the legal marriage was done away. Joseph died, and then they got back together because, as I said, no legal divorce had occurred, and this was with the sanction of Brigham Young. But that whole timeline that Todd very carefully presented is undermined by the fact that there was an additional document, at least as valid, putting the marriage date a full year later.
And the other thing, too, which again, Todd Compton does address, is the fact that Sylvia said, you know, I was separated from my husband. You know, we had split up. We were apart before I married Joseph. His reaction to that is, well, she's either trying to make this sound better than it is, or she's mistaking the date or whatever. But if we use the later date, the 1843 date, then it all fits. Then she doesn't have to retroactively change her story or try to explain it away. It fits. So there actually is, I think, data that itches us towards you, if I can say it that way.
Well, there's two quotes in the Andrew Jensen papers that also support there was a separation or divorce and timing it after Windsor's excommunication. Plus, there's other isolated observations that I won't go into here. They're in my book, and I think they're on the website, my website. But the point is that that is not a test case. And Andrew, I wanted to also mention, I have only found evidence for two children to all of Joseph's plural wives. Josephine is one, and she came out to Utah, married a guy named Fisher, lived in Bountiful. If you know any Fishers from Bountiful, they probably have Joseph's DNA in him, at least in my opinion. They've done DNA testing, and there is a correlation. The problem is there's cross-marrying in the lines besides Joseph and Sylvia, and Hugo Perrigo, who's the expert and has looked at this, says we just probably will never know from DNA testing because of all of the static. Now, the second child, we don't even know the gender, but the child was born to Olive Frost. Both Olive and the child died before the Saints left Nauvoo. So I've got on my website and in my book a list of 18 children that somebody somewhere said Joseph fathered, and it's almost comical because if a woman got pregnant and Joseph was within 20 miles, there's probably somebody out there saying he was the father. But Hugo Perrigo has gone through and ruled out the six most likely ones, but I put them all there and people can look at them, but some of them are pretty entertaining.
Right. Yeah, putting a plug in for Brian's work, I can honestly say that I was highly skeptical when I first heard Brian's theory, or heard about it, I should say. But after reading through what he had available, I went to a presentation of his, and I went up to him afterwards, and I said, okay, you have me kind of convinced, but I'm not going to be convinced really until I see the documentation that you have. And so he sent it to me, and I read through it, and kind of like Greg, after seeing what he had, after seeing it all laid out, I'm thoroughly convinced that he's correct on this, and it really does fit. The different pieces fit in like a puzzle coming together.
I really think in 10 years people won't be writing that Joseph practiced sexual polyandry, because there's just no supportive evidence. You can't prove a negative, but you know, the fact that there isn't any supportive evidence is very consistent with my position that it didn't happen. So
you're more optimistic than me, because he's more optimistic than me. Anti-Mormons are going to be writing that Joseph practiced sexual polyandry forever. It's there's far less good arguments that they're still clinging to. But hopefully people with, you know, sense and some respect for the data won't be. But that one will never die, I'm afraid.
Yeah, there are some people out there who write books who are really not interested about evidence at all. They're really just interested about things. So I just had one quick question kind of to follow up on that. Now, you talked mainly about the polyandrous type relationships. What do we know about sexuality in the other plural marriages that Joseph was involved with to single women? Is it is it absolutely certain that all of them were sexual relationships? I mean, I assume that the majority of those, what was it, 16 kids that you think that somebody somewhere has identified, that the majority, if not all of those, would have emerged from single women who were then married to Joseph. What do we know about sexuality and Joseph in the rest of his polygamous, non-polyandrous marriages?
Actually, the children that are alleged the mothers are not always on my list of 35 women, which is kind of interesting. That just shows you how extreme people will be to try to tie back to Joseph. I've documented 12 marriages with sexuality that I think is pretty reliable, with some ambiguous evidence in 3 more, and that's 15 total max. There's not evidence for more than that. That's still quite a few. Of the 35 total, though, I would not be surprised if even half of these were just eternity-only seedlings that had no sexuality involved with them. Getting back, though, to the topic, some people want to portray Joseph as being driven by sex. The evidence is real strong. He did not have a lot of sexual relations with these women. In fact, most of the people in Nauvoo did not know about plural marriage. If they'd have seen Joseph with one of his plural wives, they would have thought something was up, that was wrong. In fact, we see Clara Marvel, who was rooming in the same cottage with Agnes Coolbrith. And she didn't know about plural marriage. She didn't know that Agnes was a plural wife of Joseph, but she saw something. And she was a devout member of the church. She was a member of the Relief Society. She just didn't say, oh, it must be okay because Joseph is such a charismatic guy and he's so cool and gave us the Book of Mormon, so I'll just be quiet. No, he took that right to the president of the Relief Society, who was Emma Smith, and caused a big stir. And I believe that whatever Joseph was doing, he was being watched by everybody. He lived in a fishbowl. People who portray him as having a lot of sexual relations with his plural wives, I think, are just talking about comic book stuff because there's just not evidence to support it, and there's a lot of reasons to believe he just could not have done it.
Okay. Great. Let's move on then to Greg as we talk about people who are talking about things that they may not exactly have evidence for. Greg, you were elected to talk about some of the early reputation and accusations against Joseph in the time period and what was going on.
Right. Well, new religions, or religions that are not the majority, you know, minority religions, especially when they deviate in a significant way from the religions of the majority, they're almost always greeted by suspicion. I don't think that's a radical claim or something that anybody watching this has any difficulty believing. That's just human nature. And even today, if you study the literature about what the scholars call new religious movements, or sometimes called cults, you know, things like the Moonies or you know, Jim Jones or stuff like that, you will see that the charge of sexual impropriety or sexual deviance is virtually always raised against these groups or against their leaders, even if there's no evidence. I mean, scholars will talk about this, how, you know, it's always accused at them, but very often there's no evidence that this happens. And that dynamic was certainly in place, if not more so, in the United States in the 1820s and 1830s. And as everybody, again, watching this knows, Joseph met enormous ridicule, persecution, and resistance even before the church was organized. You know, as soon as he began talking about the Book of Mormon and gold plates, the gloves came off in newspapers and people around him. And he and his family were later charged with being drunks and being lazy and dishonest and scheming and ignorant and blasphemous. I mean, you name it, it was said about the Smiths. As William Smith, Joseph's older brother, said at one point many years later, the Smiths never knew they were bad people, or such bad people, until Joseph started to have his revelations. And then suddenly they were no longer respectable folk. So despite all that, despite, you know, how easy this kind of charge would have been, that Joseph as a young man was a libertine, or that he was sleeping around, or that he was always making improper advances, despite that, there are hardly any contemporaneous charges about that at all, or for cheating on his wife, or for trying to seduce someone. They just aren't there before plural marriage enters the scene, really, in the 1840s. And even then, it's limited. The couple examples that are worth thinking about: in 1830, Joseph was brought into one of many court cases. One of the things he was charged with was having, quote, improper conduct, close quote, towards two of the Stoll daughters. You remember Stoll was the guy who had hired Joseph to dig for the silver mine. And so supposedly he was making improper advances to these daughters. We don't know much about that. All we know really is that Joseph wrote in his history that they called the girls to the stand and that their testimony basically exonerated him, that he wasn't really charged with anything. Certainly nobody else at the time mentioned it. It never gets mentioned again. And it's really hard to believe that if there was any smoke there at all, even if there were no grounds for it, but even if somebody could make that stick, that the neighbor or the other opponents that Joseph had in the area didn't run with it. And yet they didn't. It just dies. You see the same thing in 1834. A man named Levi Lewis, who was actually a cousin of Emma Smith's, Emma Hale, claimed that he had heard before the church's organization, 1825 to 1829, he had heard secondhand that Joseph had tried to seduce a woman whose name was Eliza Winters. And he claimed that Joseph and Martin Harris had said to him that adultery was no crime. Now, that's a very strange claim for a number of reasons, again. One, Joseph, as I think Brian has pointed out really well here, this did not match what Joseph's teaching was. The church took a very strict view of sexual misadventure, you might say. And so it's strange that Joseph would say that, strange if Martin would say that. And even if they believed it, why would they say it to a hostile member of Emma's family? Everybody, they all knew, I mean, Joseph knew and others knew that Emma's family did not like his religious ideas, did not like his pretensions to be a prophet. They eventually left because they couldn't put up with living with her family anymore. So why on earth would you make such a damning admission to the cousin of your wife? That just smells to high heaven to me. In the second place, no other member of Emma's family, all of whom also gave affidavits, this is the Hurlburt Howe affidavits, kind of some of the earliest anti-Mormon stuff to come out, and that remains the base of much anti-Mormon literature today. He had several, his father-in-law, his brother-in-law, his other cousins giving evidence, and none of them say anything about this. Again, that's leaving an awful big stick to beat Joseph with laying aside. I mean, what father-in-law, you know, if he was displeased with what his son-in-law was doing, wouldn't say, and not only is the bounder a liar about religion, he cheated on my daughter, or he tried to. And yet, again, nothing comes up on this. The third thing that's made very strange about it is the woman herself, Eliza Winter. She kind of enters back to Mormon history in an interesting way. In 1832, Martin Harris and his brother Emer are on a mission in her area. And he announces from the stand that she has had a bastard child, that she's conceived a child illegitimately, which is a scandalous charge to make against someone. Well, she is no shrinking violet. She turns around and sues him for slander, sues him for $1,000, which is a lot of money back then, because he had, quote, damaged her, quote, good name, fame, behavior, and character, close quote, because, quote, his words render her infamous and scandalous among her neighbors. So this is not a shy, retiring woman who's just going to take it. She's being charged with a sexual crime, and she's hitting back with both barrels. She's not only denying it, claiming it's a vicious lie, and wants money to make up for it. Well, Martin won that suit. We don't really know why. Either it was proved to be true, in which case it can't be slanderous because you can't slander someone with the truth, or Eliza didn't have a good reputation to protect, or we don't know why, but in any case, it didn't go anywhere. Certainly, this is a woman who would not have had good memories of the Mormons. A Mormon preacher basically called her to repentance over the stand, gave her a huge, pointed out her sins in public and made a scandalous accusation, and then disgraced her again when he got away with it after she tried to sue him. So if there was ever a time to bring up this story, surely this is the time. Why wasn't she out saying, and this preacher, you can't trust what he says because the guy who started the religion he's part of, he tried to seduce me. Well, she doesn't do that. It doesn't even come up. And then later on, she's interviewed by someone writing an anti-Mormon book back, I believe in the 1870s, I think 1879. And she again is, she doesn't have really nice things to say about the Mormons, but she doesn't say a single word about this supposed seduction, which again, this is a prime opportunity. You know, she could have nursed grudges all these years against Martin and other people, and yet she didn't. And finally, no Mormon ever picked up that charge either and ran with it, died the death. So you just have these two little things out there that otherwise doesn't seem to fit the fact sense. And yet, with all the people who are trying everything they could do to oppose the church or to oppose Joseph for good motives and bad, they never used this very handy club that seems to have been handed to them. Other than that, there's this vast silence, and it really isn't until decades later where you start to see these charges of, oh yeah, I remember when Joseph, you know, 40 years ago when he was a boy, did thus and such. And there's plausibility problems with that. So it's just astonishing to me. It's incredible in the formal sense of the word. I just can't believe that if there was any fire with this smoke, that people wouldn't have run with it. It's the sort of thing that you would have expected them to run with even if there wasn't much there, and they didn't even do that. And I know Brian's done some work on this. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Brian.
Well, yeah, the only thing I would add, that's a great review, is that you mentioned improper conduct in the 1830 trial in Broome County, and that charge of there being improper conduct actually is not in the records of the court because we don't have any records. The person who actually said there was improper conduct charge against Joseph was Dan Vogel. Dan is the first person to actually come out and say that. In fact, he implies in his footnote that there was some testimony to that effect, and that's his speculation. I've actually emailed back and forth on him, and he says, well, if I'd have found any evidence, I certainly would have used it. Well, I'm saying, well, the fact that there is no evidence means you can't tell what he was accused of, whether it was proper conduct or improper conduct. They did call the women, so you could assume that there was something going on, but all of the sources say he was completely exonerated in all of the testimony. So anyway, I just thought I'd bring that up. When you say people are really going to extremes, we have to wait until, you know, 1996 or whenever Vogel's book came out for us to find somebody accusing him of improper conduct that isn't in the original records. So,
and also regarding anti-Mormon literature, you know, talking about the immoral character of Joseph Smith, as Greg brought out and Brian and I have talked about this before, accusations against Joseph Smith's character in terms of morality, most of those came after he was dead. You look at British anti-Mormon literature, and while there are accusations against Joseph Smith and the Smith family for drinking, carousing, magic, you name it, all these different things, in terms of sexual morality and accusations of immorality on the part of Joseph Smith, that these accusations were made after he was killed. And, you know, I find that interesting. Now people can say, well, that's because most of the world didn't know about Joseph Smith's polygamy. Well, perhaps, but it's also a lot easier to defame someone when they're not around to defend themselves. So I just find that interesting.
Well, and again, the fact that it didn't get done just out of spite with no evidence at all is astonishing to me. That's still the really amazing thing about it, is that there wasn't more of it, and yet it just ain't there. It's and I didn't know that about Vogel. I mean, this is a good example of how one bit of data will get kind of passed on and believed by people with the best will in the world. You know, if you make one mistake somewhere and it just kind of trickles through everything thereafter until someone like Brian goes back and kind of holds our nose to the grindstone and says, okay, you know, where is this coming from? Don't cite me Vogel, don't cite me Brody, you know, show me where it comes from. And suddenly you find out, oh my word, there's nothing there at all. Yeah. And so that's a cautionary, I guess.
Yeah, cautionary tale about the assumptions we make and the way we read into evidence. There's always a lot of that going about. I mean, we talk about Brian mentioning all the other historians that say maybe this occurred, maybe this didn't occur, kind of thing. A lot of those stances are based on the assumptions or beliefs of that author and their worldview. So as we're starting to wrap up, just a general kind of question for all of the panel, and one or more of you, whoever wants to answer these, can ask, how prevalent was polygamy in Nauvoo and then later in the West when we're talking about numbers of people who were associated with it, number of people who were practicing it, what percentage of families in Nauvoo were polygamous? Do we have any kind of data on that?
The data that I have come up with for Nauvoo, and I can't speak beyond that, but I believe that at Joseph's death there were 115 Nauvoo polygamists total. Joseph,
meaning the males?
No,
or
no, that's total. There were
total
29
people.
Men, 30 with Joseph, and then there were 85 wives amongst them. But what's interesting is that by the end of 1842, okay, we're talking 2.5 years before the martyrdom, there were only three living male polygamists in Nauvoo. It was Joseph and Heber and Brigham. And Brigham and Heber each had one wife, and Joseph had probably a half a dozen, but I believe only one of them was Time and Eternity. Again, there's a lot of pushback on that, but I'm going to hold my own on this. We got to get the evidence out there. But there was very little actual polygamy going on by the end of 42. By the end of 43, we have about half of that 115 involved, and then during the first 6 months, the rest, it starts to take off. So I don't know if Greg or Craig had numbers beyond that, but that's the one that I use. George D. Smith has a higher number, but I think there's problems with some of his data. So
I don't consider myself I don't think I have any other numbers than what Brian said for Nauvoo. Greg might. I know that for the Utah Territory period, when plural marriage was being practiced, we keep hearing the number of 3%, and that just is absolutely incorrect. I think most historians would agree that it's closer to about 20% overall. But that varied because some communities, it would be quite high, and then other communities, next to no one within the community practiced plural marriage. One of the best people on this is Ben Bennion. And if I am correct, Ben has also given it around 18 to 20% overall. And he has done just an incredible amount of research looking at plural marriage by community, tracking the different families. So I think we're safe in saying that that's a good number around there.
Yeah, that's probably true. 15 to 20% is the number that most people have kind of settled on. As Craig says, there's one place, for example, called Orderville that was really dedicated. They were trying to reestablish the United Order. So it was a communal living, you know. They were, you might call them Shiite Mormons almost. They were really, really dedicated folks. You got to admire them. And the rates of marriage there were about 60%. But as Craig says, you go elsewhere and it's much lower. Another way to think about this is they say, you know, about 25% of women years in the church was spent in a plural marriage, and about 50% of children years was spent in a plural family. So while the number of plural marriages was always a minority, you know, 20%-ish, the impact that had on Mormon society, Mormon culture, the Mormon experience was disproportionate. You know, a lot of people were affected by that. And those people tended to be the leaders, the bishops, the stake presidents, the general authorities. You really couldn't be a leader in the early church in Utah without being a polygamist. So it's a small core group, but it's a very influential core group that really, and that I think is why people can sometimes get the sense, oh my word, they were all polygamists. Well, no, they weren't. But the polygamists were much more visible for a variety of reasons, right. And everybody else kind of fades into the monogamous background, you might say.
Right. Now, how would someone become involved then in this core group? Was it by invitation only? Could you petition to the prophet and say, hey, I want to get involved. I want to get me an extra wife. Like, how would that work?
Yes, both ways. Certain men were approached by church leaders and were told that they felt that the man should enter into plural marriage, or asked them that to consider entering into plural marriage. And then there are other individuals who decided that they would like to enter into plural marriage, so they would approach church leaders and ask for permission to look for another wife. The story is told that you know they were very careful in allowing plural marriage because they did not want to have unfortunate circumstances. They didn't want to have marriages that were bad, and reality is, yeah, that happened. There were plural marriages that were just bad from the word go, but they did, the church leaders did the best that they could to make sure that the right people were selected to participate in this, and that there's the folklore story that a man approached Brigham Young and asked for permission to enter into plural marriage, and I'm paraphrasing here, but Brigham Young basically said, no, we don't want any more of your type, and so I don't know how true that is. That's what I have read and heard, but it wouldn't be surprising, one, because Brigham Young was extremely blunt, but two, they really were tried to be careful in who they allowed to enter into plural marriage, because they were trying to find individuals that they felt to, one, could live it in a proper way and not you know, do things that that were improper, or to not mistreat the various wives.
It's worth pointing out too that Utah had the most liberal divorce laws in the Union, well, or even before they were in the Union, in anywhere in the United States. A woman could, under Brigham Young, pretty much get a divorce just by asking for one. It was not a hard thing. Men, on the other hand, were not smiled upon by Brigham in those efforts.
Right.
The divorce rate of plural marriage couples was probably about 10%. Which when you look at our 50% in this day and age, looks not bad. The monogamous rate at the same time was about 1%. So certainly there were more problems with those relationships, as you would expect. But interestingly, a lot of the women who did end up getting divorced then remarried in another plural relationship. So yes, it wasn't that they were soured on the entire institution. It was just that either the husband or, in probably in a lot of cases, they couldn't get along with the other wives. There's a story, not apocryphal, of a man who had three plural wives, and they all lived together in kind of a one-room adobe hut out in the middle of the Utah desert, I think. And they had an upstairs and a downstairs. And the man was quoted as saying that it would be a happy day in his life if he could come downstairs and not find a fight in the kitchen. You know, so you got to have sympathy for that, I suppose. So was it tough? Sure it was, but it's amazing how well it worked, all things considered.
Yes.
Well, I think we're almost out of time. I want to ask one kind of last question. I mean, a lot of church members today feel that, you know, the manifesto was 1890. It's more than 100 years ago. Why is it important for us to even know about this today? It shouldn't impact us at all. And yet we know that it absolutely does. That this is an issue for people, because, you know, depending on the way you look at it, it's going to impinge on Joseph, and therefore that casts into question a lot of everything that's going on, and people need to know about this. So it's important that we definitely know about this. Maybe we can just ask, how can we talk about polygamy better in the church today? What kind of resources are there? Where can we go? How can we discuss it if it comes up in Sunday school, if we can go wherever? And how does that interact then with the church's stance on monogamy as the norm now? How do these things work in the church today? Does anybody have any?
Well, I like to tell people that I'm a firm believer in plural marriage. I'm also a firm believer that when the prophet receives revelation that we don't practice it, then we don't practice it. And so I think that Joseph Smith was inspired to introduce plural marriage, and I think that Wilford Woodruff was inspired to stop, or at least begin the process of stopping the practice of plural marriage when that took place. I think the best way that we as church members can approach this topic is to be as open as possible about it. Unfortunately, you know, it's human nature to not talk about things that we think might possibly be embarrassing or might possibly be uncomfortable. We try to just ignore something like that, and so it's human nature to not talk about it. But both our critics and people who honestly have questions, they're going to wonder, you know, if we get embarrassed about, if they ask about Joseph Smith and polygamy or a polygamous past. I have a firm rule for myself that whenever I'm talking to people who are not members of the church and they bring up polygamy, I immediately say, absolutely. We practiced polygamy. My great-grandfather had 5 wives and 30 children. I come from the 5th wife, 26th child. And then I proceed to tell them that we no longer practice plural marriage, and just give kind of a really quick overview, emphasizing the fact that that while we believe Joseph Smith was inspired to introduce it, we do not practice it today, and we feel that is through, again, through heavenly inspiration that we don't.
I would say a few things. One, when we talk about this in the church, we need to make sure our facts are right. And there's a lot of stuff that we don't know about, and I think you've seen that as we talk today, how even stuff that historians or experts have believed maybe isn't as well-grounded as they think. The other thing is there's a lot of what you might kind of call folk doctrine that gets passed around, and that stuff contributes a lot to the hurt that a lot of people experience over this topic, and I think we really need to get away from that. Just let me give you 2 examples of that. One example is, well, the only reason they got married was to provide for the widows as they cross the plains. This just isn't true. I mean, people have said it. I knew missionaries who said it on my mission. I probably said it on my mission, not knowing any better. I repent. But it's just not true, and we got to quit saying it, because then if someone learns that it isn't true, then they say, well, why was I lied to? Well, no one set out to lie to you. It's just I heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody who said, oh, that sounds like a good idea. So don't say that. It's not true. The second thing is, the other thing that I think is even worse when this topic comes up is when you get some, and it's always a man, I'm sorry to say, it's always some man on the back row of the building who will start to talk about how great it's going to be when it comes back and how we're all going to be required to live it. Well, in the official church manuals, there's nothing that says that this is something that we're going to have to do. I firmly believe God would never require anybody to do anything in the eternities that they wouldn't want to do and just be filled with joy to do. So anybody who's worried they're going to have to do this, please relax, you know, and let's not make those burdens any worse. This touches a lot of things in people, you know. It brings up all the sorts of issues like the abuse of power and, you know, the exploitation of women by men. And, you know, if a woman has had a negative experience with a priesthood leader in the church, this is going to stir all that up. And so we really need to be sensitive about it. And the third thing I would say, or the last thing I'll say out of my condensed 1-hour speech on the topic is you know, we really don't know why they did this. They came up with ideas, but I'll read you what Franklin D. Richard's wife said about him having to do this. He said, Mr. Richard, in talking of these early days, that is the early days of polygamy, and in reply to my questions as to how he reasoned about it when the matter was first considered as a personal obligation, was a little evasive. So even then, he didn't really want to talk about the experience. But at last he told me that at first it was a bitter pill, but the Lord required it, and we had to look for the explanation and reason afterward. So it's something that the people who had to do it, really, it came down to revelation. And on the Fair Wiki, we've got lots of examples of people who were deeply troubled by this, I think just like we may be today. And the only thing that settled their mind was revelation, to have God say, you know what, I'm still with Joseph, I'm still with the church, it's okay. You know, and I think we need that same sort of thing. And so we should be careful about, Elder Oaks once said that he had great confidence in the commandments, but very little confidence in the reasons we sometimes give for those commandments. And I think in plural marriage, that applies in spades. And lastly, I'll just read a remark by Heber C. Kimball. This is in The Throes of Polygamy, 1855. This is what Heber C. Kimball, a devout polygamist, I think he may have even been the record holder for a number of wives, said about plural marriage. Quote, the principle of plurality of wives will never be done away. That is, there'll always be, in some context, something where it may be appropriate. I think that's my clause. Although, he says, some sisters have had revelations that when this time passes away and they go through the veil, every woman will have a husband to herself. Close quote. And, you know, so if Heber's going to endorse that in an LDS publication in 1855, you know, I really don't think any of the rest of us have any business telling women that they're going to have to live plural marriage in the beyond. If you have to. So it might be easy for me to say that as a man, but I've heard women say it too. So believe them and believe Heber if you don't believe me.
Yeah. Again, we would like to, on behalf of the Interpreter Foundation, we'd like to thank our panelists very much for their participation. This has gone on very long because I think it's been very, very good. We encourage all of you listeners, again, if you've gotten this far with us, which I hope you have, to visit MormonInterpreter.com for this page for this discussion and the notes that we'll supply there, as well as many other resources on Mormon scripture and Mormon thought. Thank you for your participation.